You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We're really privileged today to have a great interview with Don Tashman. And Don is the director of directors. You guys can figure that out. He's director of directors of Loaded Boards, which is what I've come to understand is the cool guys when it comes to skateboards and snowboards. So welcome, Don.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So tell me, what is it that you guys do to qualify as the cool guys?
I think that was your take on what we've been talking about.
You're telling me you're the cutting edge for skateboarding.
Well, yeah, our mission as a company is first and foremost to, you know, to spread stokes, to use skateboarding as a vehicle to spread a very positive message of personal experience and space and community. And to do so, you know, I think everyone here shares a very profound passion for skateboarding and for board sports. And we feel that our role is to innovate, to create new directions, new types of experiences in skateboarding. You know, I don't think skateboarding is, it's not any one. You know, over the years, it tends to gravitate in specific directions where it concentrates. But I think the nature of what a skateboard can be has still yet to be determined. And there's so many different, you know, flavors and approaches and experiences that can be achieved. And that's our role. That's what we strive to do, is not to step on anyone else's toes, but to build new and innovative experiences. Skateboarding.
So how did you get started in skateboarding? I mean, did you grow up in LA in a skateboarding culture?
I grew up in LA started skateboarding in the 80s when there was skateboarding that had one of its first booms, probably the second boom, I think. My mom had grown up in LA skateboarding, and so me and all my siblings kind of grew up with a skateboard under our feet. There was a big the boom of skateboarding in the mid to late 80s, which really kind of entranced me. And then I continued to skate. I went to college in New York, and to get around New York City, I spent most of my time building skateboards, as skating and building skateboards. Being in New York in the mid 90s, skateboarding was a phenomenal way to explore the city. A phenomenal method of transportation, and I just did it as a hobby for about 5 years, with no intention of turning it into business. It was only after moving back to Los Angeles in 2000 that it kind of dawned on me that, hey, I love doing this, and it's something I can continue to explore.
So when did you start this business?
So I moved back to LA in February of 2000. I'd been working for a .com in New York, and I had stock options. I'd made it, just been lucky, been at the right place in the right time, and made a decent amount of money and moved back to Los Angeles. And my dad had a clothing company in downtown LA at the time, and invited me in to work for him part-time and then to have an office to do my own thing. So between February and September of 2000, I started developing a skateboard clothing line, and soon realized that I really wasn't particularly interested, nor I think talented in apparel and fashion. It's not really my forte, my passion very much is in materials and in functionally driven design. And like I said, it was a bit of one of those kind of epiphanies. I remember it was a Friday night in September of 2000, sitting down to dinner with my dad and just saying, hey, this is what I've been doing for 5 years as a hobby. This is really what I should be doing. And his response was like, yeah, you should run with it. And he ended up I said he brought me in to work for him part-time, and he ended up really working for me for the next 7 years.
Really?
run, you know, he ran the whole business side of the company. And it was a great experience for me, having that opportunity to work with him and his knowledge.
Wow. Well, so what was your idea when you got started?
I think our initial, in the mid 90s, I started snowboarding. In the early 90s, I started snowboarding, and I love snowboarding. And so the skateboards that I was developing were trying to emulate snowboarding on the streets. And in the mid 90s, skateboarding was, at least in my experience, was kind of on a downtrend. And it, the nature of what a skateboard was, you know, when you went to a store to buy a skateboard, it was almost always a 32, 33 inch deck with small, you know, 50s to give or take 50 millimeter wheels. They're very small at that point. Mm-hmm. So not ideal and hard, and intended for tricks, and very different than what, you know, not really appropriate for a city like New York, or at least for transportation and movement around the city. So I would find all these kind of, you know, these fringe skateboard components, these soft wheels, some decks that were kind of throwbacks to the 70s when there was a lot of exploration in skateboard design. And that's what I was, and I would take my old snowboards, cut them up and make them into skateboards. And then when starting the company, the initial kind of innovation, and I wasn't the only one to do it, but I definitely did it in my own, in a unique way, was to apply snowboard technology to skateboards. So composite materials, you know, the vast majority of skateboards have and continue to be made out of maple plies. And we've, you know, our standard materials are fiberglass, epoxy, bamboo, other types of composites, carbons and Kevlars and different woods. But we have very few of our products are made in a traditional skateboard fashion. You know, we've used these materials because what you can achieve with these materials is, from a user experience perspective, is incredibly different than a maple ply. Although maple ply has, you know, wonderful applications in skateboarding as well.
Well, all right. So you create nice skateboards. How did you sell them?
So the initial approach, because because it was a unique user experience that wasn't really readily available, what I did is I went door to door in shop to shop around Southern California. In the, you know, we launched our first board in 2002. I spent the next 2-3 years really going door to door, and our boards were, you know, candidly, they were very ugly. They were hand cut. I was, you know, the aesthetics were, let's say, subpar at that point. But I felt that the experience was very unique. So the way that we sold them was we'd go to the shops and we'd give them a free demo board. And the intention was that the ride would sell itself. And it did. I mean, that allowed us to grow over the next few years. It was still, it was, you know, a case by case, like one by one basis. It was a slow and steady growth until about 2006. And then in 2005, 2006, we started doing videos to showcase the boards. And the timing was right. YouTube launched in 2006, and we were one of the first, if not the first, skateboard videos on YouTube. And we tended to, for a number of years, I feel we dominated the YouTube skateboard, especially longboard skateboard experience. And that helped. That was an extension of that initial marketing effort of getting people on the boards and, you know, having this visceral experience of the skateboards. The next best option, the way we were able to do that on much broader levels, was through, you know, through the realm of video. And that led to, you know, our a lot of growth over the next, you know, 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you started off with you and your father, right?
Yeah, I started with me and my father. My father working for me. I had my first employee I met in a few months after launching our boards, I was selling our, I was living in Venice Beach, and I met a couple brothers who were selling, who decided they also liked this type of skateboard, these long boards that were rather alternative skateboards. And they set up a booth on the boardwalk right outside my apartment. And we just got talking and became friends. And Eric came on board for about a year and a half, was working as our sales manager at that time.
And how have you grown? How many are in the company now?
We've grown organically, so Eric went on to grad school a couple of years later, but there's about 13 people in house right now. Uh-huh. And we work with a couple independent contractors as well. It's been my background is in literature is what I studied. So there's no strong business sensibility aside from what I got from my dad. Because of that, I feel the management of the company was very organic growth, filled with many missteps. Mm-hmm. But it's been a really interesting process to figure out how to organize that, how to structure that in a functional, productive, and fun mm-hmm. fashion.
Well, tell us some of the interesting steps that you had.
A lot of it, like I'm saying, it grew organically. So we did, feeding up what I said earlier about YouTube, we ran what we called our challenge series, where for a number of years, we'd post up videos of us doing different tricks on skateboards. And if people were able to mimic that, to achieve those same tricks and create videos of that they would post that up on YouTube, which would, was good for our branding and our marketing, but they would potentially win free product or become team riders. And a number of employees actually came through that program. A number of our team riders were created through that, and a number of those guys ended up coming in-house. And I think one of the, that's a case in point, but just in general, most of the people that have come into Loaded have just been people we've met through friends, through families. It's very infrequent for people to come on board through a traditional job recruitment process. I've always believed in, getting the right people on the bus, the Jim Collins perspective, get the right people on the bus and then decide where the bus is going, which I think is a little bit of a pat approach and maybe not as it's led to some, like I said, some missteps. Mm-hmm. Because we've often found great people and then created roles for them, as opposed to determining what the roles are first and then found the right people for that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think both are right. I think one of the things I've been working on the past couple of years more actively is on creating more detailed roles and responsibilities for the team. Mm-hmm. So creating alignment amongst the team in terms of where the direction of the company is, and clarity on amongst each of the players in terms of how they fit into that, to those objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just candidly, that's not my forte. I've had a lot of help in doing that, a lot of outside help mm-hmm. in achieving that. Once it's up and running, it's definitely a lot better. Everyone's a lot happier.
Yeah.
But that's been, once again, can't believe it's been a challenge for me. And that, I definitely enjoy what I do, and I believe we have a great team here of really committed, passionate, highly capable people. But everyone kind of running off and doing what they think is important, and not that we don't communicate. It's just coordinating those efforts and making sure that they're aligned with the overall objectives.
Right.
Is something that I've realized is important, is my, arguably my primary role.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I've reluctantly recognized as my primary role. Well, I want to build cool stuff. I want to make things.
Right.
And and design, develop, and create, and, you know.
We would call your role the role of a visionary.
That's, you know, that's where I have fun, and that's where I enjoy myself. But I think that, you know, that said, well, I'm in a position where I do function as the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and I've despite the challenges of creating those kind of roles and responsibilities, I do feel that I very much enjoy that role. You know, there's a lot of aspects, especially the financial side and thinking strategically about the structure of the business that I had much more of a reluctant businessman mentality coming into it. And over the years, I've really found the creativity and the satisfaction in learning how to develop sophisticated business plans, sophisticated from my perspective, at least, and the importance of that and the importance of creating clear, organized structure. I'm still, you know, still a work in process by all means. But it's moving in the right direction.
Well, what do you do to increase the alignment around your plan?
So what I've been doing recently that seems to be working is on a yearly basis, building out, you know, a handful of roles and responsibilities, like 7 to 10 per employee. And figuring out how, you know, going into the year, figuring out how those all align with the goal, and then sitting down with, refining it with each of them individually, and then sitting down with them every 3 weeks individually and figuring out where they are in that process. What are the challenges that they're facing? How I can help them? And then revisiting and realigning what those objectives are for the next 3 weeks or 3 months. Given the situation. And that, like I said, that I've gotten a lot of outside help in developing. I particularly want to, you know, be remiss if I didn't think, I've been part of a group called Vistage, which you may be aware of, or I was, and the chair of my group, a guy named Brian Okin, has been incredibly helpful for me in developing those methods.
So where would you say accountability is in your organization?
That's a great question. Well, I'll take it back a step. I mentioned that in the late 90s, I was working for .com in New York. And I worked for a company that, when I came in, there was about 70 employees. I was employee number 70, give or take. And when I left, there was about 300 employees, you know, a year later. And there was no accountability whatsoever. And that was, it was very frustrating. And that was something that I was really, was committed that in whatever situation, in whatever business I went into, I would, you know, that accountability would be first and foremost. And, or that everybody that I worked with would have a sense of accountability. And I don't know that I have, you know, I know that I have not achieved that. In many ways, I've brought in some very passionate people who believe strongly in the vision and the product that we build. But the nature of account, you know, maintaining accountability has been, I don't run a draconian company. I'm not, you know, I'm not, I would say I'm not very tough in my approach. And, you know, I have high expectations, but, figuring out how to, I don't know that I have a great answer. I know that I'm moving in a better direction by having these clear objectives per person, and that having that every 3 week follow up makes it clear to both sides whether or not people are actually achieving what they should be, and clarifies it. You know, over time you see clearly why that is. So that's been very helpful in terms of achieving accountability, but I don't know that I have the perfect solution by any means.
Well, you asked them when you asked them are they willing to do this, or what are they willing to do to solve this particular problem? They give you an answer, don't they?
They do. So, you know, and when we develop those roles and responsibilities, I'll spearhead that. But each of them, especially at this point, I've got a, you know, like I said, a experienced, knowledgeable crew who knows what their capabilities are. They, each of them does commit to, they commit to those objectives. They're not, these aren't objectives that I'm putting down unilaterally, which, you know, are not, may not be achievable, or maybe my expectations are very different. These are objectives that that we determine together based on specific dates that we set up together.
Right.
So they, you know, at that point, unless there's unforeseen circumstances or there's other projects that pop up, which obviously does happen, mm-hmm. it does become blatantly obvious if people aren't pulling their weight and aren't doing what they've set out to achieve. Mm-hmm. Which thankfully with the team that I have, and I do feel, once again, it's a great team, and it's taken, 20 years to develop a great team, or to refine a great team rather.
Right.
And there's still work to be done. But at this point, I know everyone well on the team, and I do see that people are, you know, it might be a chicken or egg thing, but having those kind of objectives in place, I do see people hitting those goals consistently. And that's been, not only is it, you know, good for the business and, reduces a lot of stress and need for oversight on my end, but I see from my team that they find it very gratifying as well. They know what they're achieving. They know what they're, what they've set out to do. They can see it objectively, and they can, they feel appreciated for those efforts.
Right. Well, but my question is that working? I mean, are you having a high degree of
attention? It is.
Oh, good.
It is. Good. Yeah, I know it is. But it's definitely, you know, it's still maybe a little too early to tell for sure where it's going to go. But because this has been, I've been improving that process over a number of years. But this past, going into 2020 is when I made some substantial changes. And it does seem to be working very well.
Well, very good. Very good.
Yeah. And, you know, and the way we do it, to get into a little bit more technical detail, is I have a Google spreadsheet in place for each person, mm-hmm. where they have those goals. They have those goals on a, you know, it's, I actually just took a Gantt chart and I modified that and, you know, built it out on a calendar year, mm-hmm. and said, you know, these are your 7-8 objectives, primary objectives. And this is when we're going to plan out together to get it done over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. And so we've both been involved in that process. It's not, like I said, it's not a unilateral decision. Mm-hmm. And it seems, like I said, it seems to be working. We seem to be on track.
When you have your Gantt chart, that carries you from January through the end of the year, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Would it make sense to have a quarter? Where are we going to be 90 days from now? So each quarter we're looking to make sure that we've made progress to that point?
Very much. We do that. We do exactly that. So it's a Gantt chart that's split by quarter. Mm-hmm. It's split by month. So we can, you know, there's certain projects that are ongoing. The marketing team will have ongoing mm-hmm. efforts like maintaining their social media presence. And that'll be, you know, throughout the year. But then there'll be other specific objectives, let's say to run specific types of events. And those would have specific, clear demarcations in time and how to measure whether or not it was successful, mm-hmm. In an objective fashion. And we set that up and from the get-go, it's like, these are the goals that we're looking to achieve with them. And this is the date that this needs to be done. Or this is the amount of progress that needs to occur by this date. Mm-hmm. And like I said, regrouping or meeting for an hour or two with each teammate with each team member for every 3 weeks, mm-hmm. Has seemed to be a good, that's been a challenge for me as how to do, meetings, you know, I know that's a challenge for many businesses, and I've talked to numerous friends in all different types of industries about how they do meetings. And, you know, the initial response is, I hate meetings. They tend to be a waste of time. So how do you, And but yet, you know, that's what I found, and you know, and I find that, or people, either people come to hear themselves talk, or you know, they want to know what's going on, and the meetings are a chance for, you know, for me or someone else to just share what's happening, and that's, I don't think that's an ideal use of a meeting. You know, I've been trying to orient the meetings towards is making them into productive, collaborative experiences.
Right. Well, that's what I was curious about what, when you said you're meeting individually with each one of your people every 3 weeks.
With all 13, but with you know, with the I guess the ones that report directly to me.
Yeah. Okay. So you're meeting with them individually. Would it make sense to meet with them once a week to look at issues, to find out, you know, are we hitting our goals? Are we getting the things done that we said that we get done, and let them hold each other accountable?
So we do meet constantly. I mean, we're in an open office, and you know, there's constantly little sidebar conversations that are happening. This is allowing us both to understand the trajectory. You know, because in a modern day business with emails and all the interruptions that you get, you know, it's very easy to be busy all day and not get anything done.
Right.
You know, the goal of these roles and responsibilities, these charts that we're creating, are to make sure that the big picture is getting done, that we set our big picture agendas and objectives, and that to make sure that we're on track with that, and that the other stuff that crops up in the middle, either we understand it as a distraction, or we implement it into this project basis if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helped out. And yeah, we're meeting constantly. I mean, we're a small team.
Yeah.
And we have an open office environment. So there's you know, every day that we're all talking throughout the day and holding each other responsible for what we set out to do. My next intention, actually, speaking of that, is to take these Gantt charts or these charts and actually post them up so that everybody can see them. We've shared them internally. You know, the team has shared them with each other at specific occasions, and that helps, so everyone knows what everyone else has on their page.
Mm-hmm.
But that is something I'm figuring out right now, how to make that even more transparent and more across the team, across the board, and where it's not me or anyone else having to share, just, you know, to regurgitate the information over and over. Just how do we share that?
Interesting.
That part's a working process.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, so talk to me about sales. You at some point you added snowboards to your product line, didn't you?
So we added snowboards in 2014, I believe. That's actually been a little bit challenging. We do most of our manufacturing in the United States, and manufacturing snowboards in the U.S. is challenging. It's a challenging. There's just a lot that goes into it. The costs are high. And to be competitive, it's difficult. So we're revisiting that. Our recent endeavor has been electric skateboards. We built decks and wheels for the largest electric skateboard company, a company called Boosted, between 2014 and end of 2017. And then we decided to go our separate ways. And then 2018, we teamed up with another company based out of Barcelona, a group of electrical engineers called Unlimited. And they built an electric skateboard, a modular electric skateboard system that can fit on any skateboard and transform it into an electric skateboard.
Mm-hmm.
And we took over everything from financing to marketing and sales and distribution, and have been involved in design while they run the electrical engineering side of it and the electrical mechanical side and the customer service end of it alongside us. And that's been exciting. It's definitely a new a new industry for us. You know, and it, snowboarding was an extension of what we did to a large extent, but this is a new clientele, a new demographic, and it's the level of complexity of the systems is considerably higher, considerably more challenging.
Electric. Electric machines to drive around, right?
Yeah, I mean, these things go, you know, 23 to 26 miles an hour. They are very powerful, very fast, light, you know, relatively light, about 15, 16 pounds. So you can take it with you in, you know, into the house, on the subway. They're definitely maybe not electric skateboards. I would recommend that you be comfortable on a skateboard before you get on one of these. Mm-hmm. But they're a lot of fun. They're really an amazing experience. And also, if you are comfortable on it from a transportation and functional perspective, they're incredible vehicles. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of my interest in getting involved in this is I am very fascinated by micromobility and how transportation is changing and how we move through space. And I want to be part of that conversation.
Yeah. Well, talk about sales now. So you've got skateboards, you got snowboards and you have electric skateboards. Talk about your sales.
Sure. So we have, I think, five primary channels. We have two in-house brands, Loaded and Orangutan. Loaded is the deck brand. Orangutan is our wheels. We also distribute a truck brand called Paris, and we do the unlimited electric side. And our primary methods, our primary sales channels are what we call OEM, where we sell our products to other manufacturers. And we do quite a bit of this on the wheel side, especially to other electric board companies and other skateboard companies, because we have our own proprietary wheels that we've been developing for 12 years now, but our decks as well. Then beyond that, we have a distributor network where we work with about close to 50 distributors around the world right now. One distributor per country is our approach. And those distributors sell to all their local shops and maintain, you know, we find people that we feel have a really strong grasp of their local community, the local culture, and are able to represent our brand in a way that we want to see us being represented. And that's something that Pablo here, who runs our international sales, is my partner as well, has really driven pretty much single-handedly has developed a longboard skateboard distribution network, worldwide distribution network. I'd say he's been the catalyst for that globally. And those distributors will resell the product to shops, to wholesalers. And then we do our own wholesale distribution in the US. So we don't sell to the US distributor. We sell to right now about 150 stores. In the 150 customers, which is, you know, about 300 to 400 doors. Mm-hmm. At one point we were in many more doors. It's been a big consolidation or a big attrition in retail, at least in our space. We're seeing it start to grow again, and we've been putting in a lot of efforts to teaming up with the right wholesalers, the right retailers. Simultaneously, we also do some direct sales through our website and through Amazon. And that's changed dramatically over the past 3 or 4 years, our approach to that.
Really? Tell us about Amazon sales. You know, what have you learned from that, and how has that affected your relationship with your customers?
It was a little sticky, but okay, I'll jump in. So it's actually interesting. So Amazon, you know, for a while we we as a brand and we as an industry kind of looked away, you know, just ignored Amazon, kind of kept our heads in the sand, and saw a lot of competition, especially direct to consumer stuff coming from direct from factory, kind of undermining all the efforts that we'd done, because our industry had prided ourselves in putting a lot of our proceeds into developing community efforts, events, marketing, branding, things that really, you know, we felt were important as an industry for the long-term health of our sport and our products, and for just, we just thought those were important from a cultural perspective. And we were finding all these brands building very similar stuff to what we were doing at a fraction of the cost, coming direct to consumer through Amazon. And it really had a huge impact on our industry as a whole. And we saw it happening and no one really knew what to do. And these companies would have just these amazing reviews on Amazon. And these were brands that we'd never heard of. We have a close relationship, thankfully, with all of our major competitors. And we were all kind of talking about this, like, what's going on? What is there we can do? How can we approach this? And what we finally decided to do is to actually kind of just to tackle it head on. And we had allowed our retailers to maintain and to sell via Amazon. We didn't really see it as that important at first. And then as we saw it grow, there came a recognition that this wasn't really, allowing our wholesaler retailers to resell on Amazon wasn't in our interest, because from the customer perspective, they were getting multiple listings. There was no coherency in the message that was being created. And we spent about a year refining our listings, cleaning that up, making it consistent, having consistent products, having very consistent pricing, at least domestically, which is important for us, you know, for maintaining the brand MSRPs. And then, you know, we gave our wholesalers almost a year of advance notice. And then January last year, January 2019, we decided that we were going to sell on Amazon Prime, and we didn't want any of our U.S. Retailers to sell on Amazon Prime. The ones that have been grandfathered in or were already selling on Amazon are allowed to continue to sell through Seller Central. But we were going to take over Prime also through Seller Central, which we've done. And what that allows us to do is it really allows us to have a better understanding of what, of the customer experience, to really make sure that we're taking care of customers, we're responding to their needs. And it also allows us to market our brand, because what was happening before, I know a lot of our retailers were spending marketing dollars in the Amazon ecosystem, but it was only once you'd already searched for our brand. So that wasn't necessarily helping the growth of our brand overall. And if we, by allowing others to sell on the Amazon system, if we don't really understand what those sales look like, we can't target the marketing effectively. And that was our intention in taking that on, which we've done, is to drive targeted and the good ROI marketing in the Amazon, in and around the Amazon ecosystem. And we've seen significant growth through Amazon because of it, but also we've seen significant growth in our retailers, which is kind of pleasantly surprising. You know, I think it's developed our brand as a whole. Mm-hmm. It's also in the process, we've limited what's available on Amazon. We've segmented it. And if you want the more, a more curated experience, you need to go to one of our retailers to get that product. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's definitely been a couple brands, a couple of our retailers who blocked out, retailers who had focused heavily on Amazon, and to their credit, they saw the opportunity and they went for it, and some of those have lost out with us. But for the most part, most of our retailers have actually taken that in stride and have been able to grow their businesses in other avenues, despite that shift.
Wow. Well, that's pretty astounding. I mean, you must be seeing a double-digit percentage growth.
On Amazon for sure, and on the retail side, we're seeing that right now. I think that, that may be a function of trends, because we are seeing that our segment of skateboarding in general, hard goods, seems to be growing right now. The skateboarding being in the Olympics probably may have something to do with it, but it does seem like it just seems to be on trend. We're seeing a new generation coming into it, a new demographic, which is a new community, which is really cool, which is a lot of fun, a lot of new energy, new creativity coming into it.
That's great. Well, what kind of advice would you have for an entrepreneur starting up, much like you did, in your father's store with an office and eventually bringing him into the business itself?
Well, I mean, I hopefully you can have that luxury and that amazing opportunity that I had to have that kind of support and mentorship. And I've always believed very, and I think this ties into it, but I've always believed very strongly in taking advantage of the opportunities that you have. If you are presented with these opportunities, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, and really try to, if you can do it, go for it. I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of in terms of having good support and mentoring. Mm-hmm. But I think the opposite. I think constantly searching for mentoring. I've no pun intended, but I feel like we've reinvented the wheel numerous times over, and it wasn't always necessary. I do think I personally I think I would have gained a lot from having a business school background. But not prior to working, not prior to starting my company. And hence doing Vistage and doing some outside business courses, and a lot of reading and podcasts. But I do think that there is a lot of value in learning from those who've been through it. Mm-hmm. Being part of a mentoring group is of tremendous value, being part of business groups. One thing that I've found to be very helpful, took me a number of years to figure this out, but was in developing budgets and projections on a yearly basis. Taking my numbers from the previous year and using that to understand how to adjust, how to tweak, how to strategize to create a healthy company. And I know maybe that's pretty obvious, but for me it took a while to figure out how to create a more sophisticated budget and projections. And I do think that that's been the key, and maintaining those budgets has been the key to our financial success.
Excellent. Well, it's been very interesting to hear about the growth from from an idea to a company that's created at least 13 jobs, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true when you put it like that, and numerous others. Because we do, it is interesting to recognize how much we obviously are able to support a number of different sub companies or aspects of those companies as well.
Right. So right.
Yeah,
that's excellent. Well, congratulations to you.
Thank you, Will.
Well, that's the kind of thing that we like to talk about on the Pilgrim on the 405, is just finding those places where businesses is thriving in Southern California. Sometimes it's larger companies, 20, 30, 40, 50 million. Sometimes it's smaller companies who are doing a fantastic job. So that's wonderful. I really want to thank you for being part of the show today.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thanks for the time.
Well, if somebody like my grandson wanted to find out more about these wonderful skateboards, how would he get in touch with you?
You can check out our stuff on at loadedboards.com and LOADDBOARDS.com. And I'm at, you're welcome to email me directly at dawn@loadedboards, dawn@loadedboards.com as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that's a wonderful example of how business in California can thrive.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.